This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. On today's program, we talk to a member of Congress visiting the southern border, investigating how Border Patrol agents are treating asylum detainees.
They're not trained to be taking care of people, and they don't seek to be doing that mission. They feel like they're not good at it, and we don't want them doing that mission.
Two anti-abortion factions disagree about strategy and ballot initiatives.
The disagreement comes down to what should be done to further restrict abortions in Michigan.
Then a review of disciplinary policies at Detroit public schools.
This concern that because so many students were being suspended, expelled from the school district, that you were just quickening that school to prison pipeline.
Plus, Tammy Coxon with Cheers to Michigan has a cocktail for us. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Right now, a bipartisan group of U.S. representatives is visiting sites along the border with Mexico. Among them is a member of Congress, Alyssa Slotkin of Michigan's 8th District, and she joins us now. Welcome to the program, Representative Slotkin.
Thanks for having me.
So you're inspecting points of entry, U.S. Customs and Border Protection Station, and an immigration detention facility in the area of McAllen, Texas. What are you seeing?
Yeah, so we've been to two spots so far. We've been to an actual border port of entry called Hidalgo in the Rio Grande Valley. So literally, it in some ways, kind of similar to what you see at our own border in Detroit. It's where cars come over, and in this case, many, many more pedestrians coming over. But it's also where people can walk up to the border and seek asylum. So we were talking to the Customs and Border folks there about the overcrowding that they're seeing. We saw actually a number of asylum seekers waiting to be processed, given the Mylar blankets, just trying to understand the stress that's on the situation and making sure that, you know, we're living up to our commitments to manage the situation in a humanitarian way with dignity. Then we also saw what's called the Donna facility, which is basically a massive warehouse that was built in 2014 when we had a prior surge in numbers of migrants. It is a place where when the Customs and Border folks at the border get overwhelmed, they bring people to this facility to be processed. And there's a bunch of CBP folks there as well. There, that facility is for families. So we saw lots of moms with their kids, people just in really, really, you know, fleeing terrible situations down in Central America. We talked to a number of these women.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if you'd had a chance to talk to any of the immigrants being held in detention. What were stories like?
Yeah, so we talked to a mother who was there with her her son, you know, who was playing with a fire truck next to us, and she was, you know, fleeing violence. She had family members who had been murdered, so she came with her son and seeking asylum. A couple of my other fellow congressmen and women were talking to another woman who was explaining how much money she was paying the smugglers and the cartels in order to get her over the border. All told, $10,000 when you successfully make it over the border, just to give people guidance on where to go and how to do it and who to call when you get to the other side. So there's definitely a massive criminal nexus going on in that's making money off of these people and their horrible, horrible situations.
What kind of conditions were they living in or staying in this center?
So, you know, I'm aware of the fact that, you know, they knew a group of members of Congress were coming, right? So,
right.
You are presented with what they give you. To be honest, the Donna facility is known as one of the best facilities. It's fully air conditioned. People had lots of space. This was families together. They had plenty of supplies. The women themselves, we asked them, you know, do you get enough to eat? Do you have access to water? And they said, yes, look around. Like, they keep the snacks and the water out all the time. We have three meals a day. Besides it being a very cold facility, which I can attest to, the conditions there, what I understand, are some of the best we've seen. What I think what we saw on the port of entry was facilities just like our border in Detroit that are absolutely not set up for this kind of number coming over the border seeking asylum. The Customs and Border folks, they're not, you know, trained to be taking care of people, and they don't seek to be doing that mission. They feel like they're not good at it, and we don't want them doing that mission. So the border locations are much tougher conditions, and my understanding is some of the facilities we're about to see here after lunch are going to be some of the more crowded and difficult places.
As we mentioned, this is a bipartisan group of members of Congress. You're a Democrat, but you're there with Republicans as well, including Paul Mitchell, who represents Michigan's 10th district. How are the Republicans reacting to what the group is seeing today?
You know, this is the part of the reason I wanted to come on this trip with them, is I think it's important that we all have the same picture of what's going on here, you know. And I've heard some of my colleagues on both sides of the aisle saying, wait, this is happening, and this is how this goes on. And, you know, we saw the line of people waiting to walk over the border, and it's hours and hours long in the hot sun. And, you know, you start to see people understand that, you know, that the system is just fundamentally broken. And I think it's important to come as a group together so that we see the same things and we can try and just suck some of the politics out of this issue.
Is that even possible these days?
Well, I think it is for this group, and I think the responsibility of lawmakers is to try, right? I had someone ask me today, you know, Congress has been thwarted, you know, in previous Congresses in any kind of bipartisan immigration reform, and we know that it's the system that's broken, and it's people who are suffering for it. And so they said, is it even worth trying? And I said, that is our job. You know, it is the job of this group to spend, as we're going to do tonight, 3 hours after we've seen what we see, just barrel down and try and get some real ideas for legislation, bipartisan legislation, and then take it back to our colleagues. And you know what? It may not work. It's such a political issue. It may not, but it is our job to try.
You've introduced a bill in Congress, the Short-Term Standards Act. It recently passed out of committee with bipartisan support. What's in that bill?
Sure. So this is a very, very simple concept, right? The Department of Homeland Security was stood up in 2002, and in its charter, in its original act that stood it up through Congress, it says that when people come over the border seeking asylum, that Customs and Border must provide food and water. And I think we all know that we need to be providing more than food and water. We need to provide for adequate shelter, temporary shelter. We need to provide for adequate hygiene, access to medical care, nutrition, right? That there are certain standards that we use across the world, right? If you are at work for the Bureau of Prisons, these are basic things that we give prisoners. If you are in the U.S. military, these are the same standards that we give our prisoners of war. So I think that those same standards should be applied to the Customs and Border folks, to a Department of Homeland Security. So it amends the original charter to include all of those things. And it got bipartisan support out of the Homeland Security Committee.
From what you've seen and heard so far on your trip, how well do you think ICE is doing in its treatment of detainees?
So we haven't yet gone to an ICE facility, so that is coming up. So we will learn more about that. Obviously, some of the stories that I've heard are extremely, extremely disturbing. And it's our job as folks, you know, in oversight roles to make sure that even if one or two cases are going on that are this horrible, that they must stop. And there must be accountability from the leadership. And, you know, I think that there is no contradiction between keeping ourselves safe, making sure we know who's coming in and into our borders and that anyone coming in doesn't pose a threat, but then also providing for the humanitarian treatment of all people. That is our mandate. And ICE and anyone else, there's no exception to that.
Are you getting a sense of whether the people who are in detention were aware of what a mess things are at the border right now before starting their trip here?
Yeah, it is clear to me. I mean, one of the things that shocked me, to be honest, in this sort of criminal nexus and the cartels that help move people over our borders, is we were there in Hidalgo, and the head of Customs and Border pointed out to me a man who was on the Mexican side of the border, right on the other side of the bridge, and he was basically an intelligence collector for the cartels. He watched what was happening at the border. He watched how many inspections were happening. He saw our congressional delegation. He sits there every day, he says, and he reports on changes at the border to the cartels. So when you're talking about a cartel having an intelligence arm, that's a higher level of sophistication, frankly, than I understood. That was pretty amazing to see, and I think my peers were similarly surprised.
What do you believe we should do to address the issue of people coming across the southern border seeking asylum? Because remember, it's not illegal to seek asylum. Is there room to negotiate with the president on how we deal with asylum seekers?
Well, I think no matter what, we have to be a place and a country that allows people to come here when they're fearing persecution and death. There are plenty of us who know that if our families a couple generations ago were in the exact same situation, we always have to have that as an option. So to me, there's no negotiating. The president has said things like getting rid of asylum. That's beyond the pale. That's not American. So to me, that's not a position that I want to negotiate on. I do think that we have the right to know when people are here waiting for their asylum cases to be heard, that they are not, you know, getting into bad activities, that we know where they are. They need to show up for their court cases. So I think there are things we can do to make sure that there's accountability on people once they come in, more than what we're doing. And I think a lot of these people want to have their day in court. They want to have a lawyer and they want to plead their case. But to me, the idea that we would be negotiating on, you know, scaling back the ability to seek asylum, I have a real problem, a real moral problem with that.
As the trip has gone so far, what's your takeaway at the moment?
I mean, my takeaway is that the policy and political disagreements in Washington have created such a broken system, and it's punishing everyone. It's punishing, first and foremost, the migrants who are coming over. It's punishing our CBP officers. It's punishing the Border Patrol. It's punishing these kids. Who are being still, in some cases, separated. And that means it's Washington's responsibility to do something. And that's part of why this trip in particular was important to me, because we're going to produce something, and then it's on the rest of Congress to either ignore it or actually get to work.
Congresswoman Alyssa Slotkin of Michigan's 8th District talking to us from a congressional trip to the southern border. Thanks for taking the time.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Coming up, pro-life advocates want to see the needle move on regulating abortion in Michigan, but they don't all agree about what should change or who should change the law, lawmakers or voters. We'll look at the internal dispute coming up next. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. High water on the Great Lakes has, in part, contributed to the decision by landowners to file a lawsuit against two government bodies about a road that leads to Lake Michigan. The road end at Lake Michigan has been used as sort of a public beach by township residents and others near Leland. The high water has led to beach visitors starting to use the private property for gatherings nearby. The families who own the land on each side of that road say, actually, this land was never the township's, and this isn't really a public beach. Joining us now is a reporter from the Traverse City Record Eagle, Patty Burgess. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
So who are these families, and what does the lawsuit demand?
The families are the Joys and Janko families. They're actually the Janko Family Trust and a Joyce Family Trust, and they own property on either side of this road, which isn't really a road. It's a sand path. And what they want is for the township to not use that area as a public beach, and they've been using it as a public beach for decades. There are signs down there that the township has put up, and they want them to remove all the signs. They have water rings down there for safety.
What kind of signs?
Warning about cold water and warning about rip currents.
So the assumption is, You can go here because, and we're going to put these warnings up so you're safe. That's what the implication is. All right.
And this has always been called South Beach, and there was a sign up there designating it as South Beach, and they've taken it down. But there's still about, maybe four or five signs down there.
Yeah, kind of conflicting messages there.
Yeah. And there's also the fact that the township did not know until about a year ago that they didn't own that land. They thought it was theirs. But it's actually, the road commission says it's theirs because it's a road end, but the families say that it was never platted as a road. So the land belongs to them. So it's a confusing issue.
We mentioned that there were two government bodies involved in this. Who did the families sue?
Leland Township and the Leelanau County Road Commission.
So what are the road commissioners and the township board saying about this?
Well, the township board is going to go into mediation, but the road commission says that they're going to fight it.
In your story, you said the families say, hey, look, this is to correct a taking of private property by the township. But the township supervisor said, hey, at least one of the families has not been paying taxes on the land. If you own something, you got to show us the deed. So how's that going to be settled in mediation?
I have no idea. I'm not an attorney, so.
Has this been a long-going argument?
No, it's only been come to light since about 2017, and it's because of the high water has put the beachgoers in such close proximity to these private properties.
So when the people are down there having fun, they're getting closer and closer to houses or just encroaching on land?
Well, you know, the public has a right to be on the beach up to the high water mark, which is, as you know, the Michigan Supreme Court has said where the water scrubs away the vegetation. But there is down there a bluff, and it's below the bluff that the beach is. And the beach is now, it used to be huge, and now it's like almost up to that bluff. So, but this has been going on for about 2 years, and they say that people are, you know, they've used their, they had a little boardwalk in there, they've used it for firewood, they have fires on the beach, and they're supposed to stay within this 60-foot right-of-way, which is apparently where the road would be.
So if this is not settled in mediation, out of court, could this lead to a decision that not just alters this access, but alters access to beaches at the end of roads in Michigan all over?
I think it could. There is already a law, though, for inland lakes, and this is not an inland lake. This is Lake Michigan, so there is no law that governs this, I don't believe.
It's going to be really interesting to see what becomes of this, because if they can't settle this, we're all going to be looking at, once more, beach access issues as we have in the last few years.
Yes.
We've been talking to Patty Burgess, reporter for the Record Eagle, who's been covering a dispute about whether a public road ending at Lake Michigan, or public path, I should say, means access to the beach for the public. Thanks very much for explaining this to us.
You're welcome.
Opponents of abortion are disagreeing about the best approach to virtually end abortions in Michigan. One group is organizing a ballot initiative to ban abortions if a fetal heartbeat can be detected. Another group is backing an initiative to ban a procedure called dilation and evacuation. But on the ballot initiative, it's described as dismemberment abortion. Lauren Gibbons with MLive has been reporting on this, and she joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So what's behind the disagreements between these two groups?
Yeah, so essentially the disagreement comes down to what should be done to further restrict abortions in Michigan. On one hand, you have Michigan Right to Life, who contends that the law that was on the books before the Roe v. Wade decision, if Roe v. Wade were to be overturned, is stronger than a fetal heartbeat ban, which is what the other group is going for. So Michigan Right to Life is looking at banning this particular dismemberment or dilation and evacuation as the medical term procedure for abortion. And the other group is looking at replicating some of those heartbeat bans that you've seen in other states like Ohio and Kentucky.
So there was a forum in Kalamazoo that you covered, and they were making the case for this Heartbeat Coalition's initiative. They say a successful effort here in Michigan could have set up a court challenge to, as you wrote, be the arrow in the heart of Roe versus Wade. That's the U.S. Supreme Court decision that legalized abortions in the U.S., of course. Is that a popular strategy?
I think so. That's what we're seeing around the country. They're looking to add to some of the other states and voices that have put these heartbeat bans out there. It's essentially a 6-week ban on pregnancy. What they're looking at is the cardiac activity of an infant in the womb, and that typically is detected around 6 weeks. So effectively, if Roe versus Wade were to be overturned, that is the ban that they're going for here. But it is it's still very up in the air, obviously, unless the Supreme Court takes this up. Courts have generally ruled these unenforceable. No heartbeat ban has gone into effect in the country as of this point.
So opponents of both initiatives have said that the proposed bans on abortion would limit options for women seeking to end a pregnancy or needing a pregnancy because of a threat to life. Where would this lead us if both of these initiatives pass in Michigan?
It probably, unless something were to change at the federal level, it probably wouldn't change too much. If they were to go into effect, it would have a lot of changes. But Roe versus Wade would likely, based on legal rulings from around the country, would probably be considered unenforceable under current federal precedent. But if these were to go into effect, the heartbeat ban, as I said previously, would essentially limit women to the first 6 weeks of pregnancy. Some women don't know that they're pregnant at that 6-week point. So that could be a limit as some Planned Parenthood and other pro-choice advocates have said. So it does potentially have a lot of implications. As far as the dismemberment or dilation and evacuation petition goes, that would mostly impact pregnancies that are terminated in the second trimester of pregnancy. And I've been told that there are other avenues, but a lot of pro-choice advocates say that dilation and evacuation is often the easiest procedure for women to take at that point in the pregnancy.
So if these initiatives are successful, and they get enough petition signatures, then the legislature could take this up, avoid the governor veto, and they could enact one or the other, or both, I suppose, if they wanted to. That's going to make it just a matter for the courts then, right?
Right, right. And there has been indication in the legislature, the House and the Senate separately both passed very similar language to the dilation and evacuation petition that is being pushed by Right to Life right now and other anti-abortion groups around the state. And there has been legislation introduced in the legislature related to the heartbeat ban, as it's called, hasn't been taken up by the legislature yet, but it is a... You know, there's a lot of support for it among anti-abortion advocates. So it's definitely something that could be taken up by the legislature. As you said, they need to get the signatures. If they get the signatures, then the legislature would have the option to take it up.
Lauren Gibbons is a reporter with M Live. The title of her story from earlier this week is Supporters of Anti-Abortion Heartbeat Ban in Michigan Push Back Against Criticism. Thanks for telling us about this.
Yeah, thanks very much for having me.
So what does it take to run a successful petition drive and get a question on the ballot? We have a listener named Tim who wrote us with several questions about the petition process that we thought were worth asking someone with the answers. As it turns out, we know a guy. Mark Brewer is an attorney with Goodman Acker, and he's the former head of the Michigan Democratic Party. He's currently working on the Adopt and Amend lawsuit before the Michigan Supreme Court that deals with how lawmakers are able to tackle ballot questions. Mark Brewer, welcome.
Thank you.
How many ballot initiatives have you been involved with?
Oh, I've probably lost count by now. I started doing ballot question work in this state in the mid-1980s. I've done them at the municipal level, the county level, and the state level.
What's the one that or two that stand out to you?
Boy, there have been so many interesting ones. I was involved early on and helped pass the Macomb County Charter. I live in Macomb County. And the effort to do that started back in the 80s. That was one of my first petition drives.
Did you have any that were really difficult to navigate because of what was going on at the time?
Well, there's always a lot of pressure out there. There are people that don't want you to do the ballot proposal, right? And, of course, you've got opponents. And in many of these cases, the opponents challenge every signature, and you get into lengthy court proceedings. One of the proposals last year, we were challenged in court by our opponents, and it ultimately took an order of the Michigan Court of Appeals to say, yes, there's enough signatures here. So, again, you expect that in every situation, and, you know, if it's not quite as divisive and as argumentative, that's great, but you expect the worst.
So let me get to Tim's questions here. The first one is, under what circumstances do ballot initiatives need to be constitutional amendments?
Well, that's really up to the people who circulate the petition. That's their choice. We have three types of petitions in Michigan. A petition for a constitutional amendment, which has actually been part of our Constitution for over a century. The voters can also initiate a statutory law. And finally, they can also do a referendum, which is an up or down vote on a law that the legislature passes.
So are different numbers of signatures required for each of those kinds of ballot initiatives?
Yes, yes. And these are all reflected in our state constitution. In order to do a referendum on a law that the legislature has already passed, you must gather the signatures from 5% of the voters in the last gubernatorial election. So what they do is they total up all those votes, and 5% of that number is the minimum necessary. For an initiative, it's 8% of that number, and for a constitutional amendment, it's 10%.
Okay, that makes sense. Becoming more increasingly harder to get on the ballot also means that once it's on the Constitution, it's increasingly hard to get off, right?
Correct, yeah. Yes.
What are the restrictions on when signatures can and must be collected?
Well, there's several parameters here. At the front end, if you're going to do a petition drive in the state, you need to form what's called a ballot question committee and report all the money you've raised and spent. So that's kind of an initial step. Then the law requires that your petition be filed with the state, and they put it on the state website so everybody knows that these are the petitions that are circulating. There's an optional process to get that petition approved as to form, which folks needn't use if they don't want to. But then once you file it with the state, you're free to circulate. You're free to circulate. The filing deadlines are generally in the spring to early summer of the election year, so you can circulate even in the off year. However, there's an important restriction that only the signatures gathered in the 180 days before you filed count. So you control that. But if you choose to file in, say, June 1, the state's only going to count the signatures going back 180 days from June 1.
Right. Gotcha. So under what circumstances are paid staff allowed to collect signatures, or for that matter, children or non-residents?
Different categories there. There are no restrictions on paid circulation, even though the legislature last winter passed a law that requires paid circulators to register with the state and imposes some pretty onerous requirements on them. Those requirements are now subject to litigation, of which I'm a part, because the U.S. Supreme Court has said this is part of the right to petition, First Amendment. You can't impose onerous conditions on folks. Out of state, folks can circulate. Again, the courts have been very clear about that.
Let me just back up, because it's more common for paid circulators than unpaid, right? I mean, usually most of these ballot initiatives are.
That's true in Michigan, and true most states as well. I mean, these signature requirements and this 180-day requirement and Michigan's weather make it a challenge to gather the number of signatures. And generally as well, you don't just gather the minimum number of signatures, because inevitably they're going to be bad signatures, right? There's going to be unregistered folks and other kinds of issues. So you generally gather what's called a cushion beyond that 5%, beyond that 8%. So it's not uncommon to hire folks to do this, because it's not easy.
You started to tell us about non-residents.
Yes, non-residents are able to serve as circulators. There are a couple of special requirements on the petitions. They have to indicate that they're a non-resident and give an address where they can be located should there be the need for an investigation. But you do have to be 18 and above.
Oh, so if I've got a darling 8-year-old kid who just is charismatic as can be, I can't put him out there with a petition.
No. There's no reason they couldn't help you, but an adult has to do the circulating. And so those are the kinds of general requirements. You don't have to be a registered voter to circulate. But again, and on the form, the circulator gives an address so they can be located in case there are any questions or problems.
Now, this gets to current news. Under what circumstances can the legislature pass a ballot initiative and then amend it to minimize or overturn its effect?
Well, that is currently in front of the Michigan Supreme Court. We just got done with the argument yesterday.
Full disclosure, you're involved in that case.
I am. Yeah. I represent two petition drives, the minimum wage and paid sick time last year, which filed petitions. We were told we had enough signatures, and we did. And under Michigan's process, then, the legislature has an opportunity to do one of three things. This is exactly what says in the Constitution. They can reject it, in which case it goes to the ballot. They can enact it, in which case it becomes a law. Or they can reject it and offer an alternative, in which case the alternative and the original proposal go on the ballot for the voters to decide. What the Michigan legislature did last year for the first time in the century that we've had this right of stature initiative was they adopted those two proposals, and then they turned around in lame duck right after the election and amended them, essentially to gut them. That is now the subject of a lawsuit pending in the Michigan Supreme Court, our argument being that you can't do that, basically, that you've either got to let the people vote or you've got to adopt it. You can't adopt it and then take it apart.
Who can sign a ballot initiative petition? Only citizens, only registered voters, permanent legal residents?
You have to be a registered voter in Michigan, and that's part of the process. Well, when the signatures are filed, they are checked, and the state and local authorities would use what's called the registered voter file of the state to check and see that the person who signed is a registered voter.
Well, thanks for coming in and answering Tim's questions.
That was great. Enjoyed it very much.
Mark Brewer is an attorney with Goodman Acker. Still to come, we'll tackle that Adopt and Amend lawsuit before the Michigan Supreme Court with our weekly political roundup. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Discipline in school is necessary, but how do you strike the right balance? Lots of teachers, administrators, and school boards struggle with how to best handle discipline without high levels of out-of-school suspensions, which mean kids aren't getting an education at all. Lori Higgins recently wrote an article for Chalkbeat Detroit about a shift in disciplinary policies in Detroit public schools, and she joins us now. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
Just fine. I hope you are too. Under Superintendent Nikolai Vitti, some new disciplinary approaches were implemented last year. How did that work out?
Well, from the district's perspective, there were some positives, but then there were areas where they felt like they needed to make some revisions. So let's go over the positives real quick. So one, they feel like the changes that they made last year provided a lot more consistency from school to school. That was one of the concerns that Dr. Vitti heard early on in his tenure in the district, was that discipline was handled differently from one school to the next, and something could get you suspended at one school, but get you, you know, expelled at another school. So that was one thing. The other is because of the changes that they put in place, they had a very significant drop in the number of students who were suspended from school.
Right. That was one of the goals, right? I mean, they wanted to see that kind of a drop in suspensions and expulsions.
That was one of the goals. I mean, if you look at the numbers last year, April 2018, they had about 17,000 students suspended from the school district. A year later, this April, they had about 12,000 students suspended from the school district. So they were able to see a big decline. However, if you talk to some teachers, they'll say that that decline happened because, you know, the changes that were put in place made it more difficult to handle discipline issues and to, you know, suspend students for various infractions. So, you know, it reduced the numbers, but you know, there were some who kind of complained that it's not really helping things.
So this year, they're trying to make some tweaks. What are they changing?
They're making some tweaks. So one of the biggest changes is they're creating a demerit system. It's like a 16-point system where these are for those kinds of things that aren't covered in the code of conduct, things like, you know, disrupting the classroom, you know, anything happening in the school days, any kind of disruption that wouldn't necessarily be a code of conduct violation, but it's still disruptive to the school environment. So a student could get a certain number of points for each of those infractions. And if they get up to 16 points, then, you know, the principal or the school leader, whoever is handling discipline, can decide. It's not automatic and it's not required, but they can decide to refer that student to an alternative school. So that's one big change. Another is, so one thing that they heard is that people felt like there was no consequence for fighting, is particularly for a student who got into their first fight. So now the change that would be made is that a student could be referred for for discipline after the first fight. Again, it's not automatic.
Even suspended, right? Yeah.
Yeah, I believe it's just suspension. I don't think that one of the options would be to send them to an alternative school. But again, it gives the school leaders flexibility. It's not required. It's not something that they have to do. But one thing that Dr. Vitti said during one of the committee meetings is, you know, when he was in a high school as a teacher, as a dean, as a school leader, he would have looked at it for each individual kid, how to handle it. So if a kid has been constantly getting in trouble and then they get into their first fight, then that might be a kid you might refer to for suspension after that first fight. But if it's a kid who's never been in trouble, got into their first fight, you might think differently about that. You might not, you know, refer them for suspension.
You know, there are a lot of data from the Office of Civil Rights that shows racial disparities in student discipline. How does that play out in a majority Black school district like Detroit?
I mean, obviously, most of the students are minority. And I think the way it plays into it is one of the things that sort of spurred the original changes last year was this concern that because so many students were being suspended, expelled from the school district, that you were just sort of quickening that school to prison pipeline that people have been concerned about for a number of years. And there was concern that, you know, when you kick kids out of school, you're taking away, obviously, their education and you're putting them out. And oftentimes kids find ways to get in trouble. And so what they were trying to do is to, you know, keep these kids in school, find better ways of dealing with discipline so that they're not contributing to that school to prison pipeline.
I wanted to ask you about one other thing. And there was a lot of talk in your piece about the school district looking at requiring or expecting respect, both for teachers, administrators, and for other students. Tell me about that.
Right. So they are launching a campaign, and I'm not clear on exactly when that's going to happen, but the campaign is all about expecting respect. And it's targeted at everyone in the system. Dr. Vitti said it's not hard to walk into a school and not see examples of students disrespecting other students, students disrespecting staff, and sometimes staff disrespecting students. And so he felt that there was a need to sort of address this on a district-wide basis and sort of promote the idea that we all need to expect respect from each other. And so that's kind of the idea behind it.
Laurie Higgins is a reporter for Chalkbeat Detroit. You can find that news site online at chalkbeat.org/Detroit. Thanks very much, Laurie.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The Michigan Supreme Court heard arguments this week on what's being called the adopt and amend strategy the legislature used to accept ballot initiatives on increasing the minimum wage and making paid sick time law. Then the legislature changed them. We heard earlier on the show from a lawyer for the backers of the initiatives, Mark Brewer.
What the Michigan legislature did last year for the first time in the century that we've had this right of stature initiative was they adopted those two proposals, and then they turned around in lame duck right after the election and amended them, essentially to gut them. I mean, they really, and I don't think anybody disputes that they've really, really dismantled what those laws were about. That is now the subject of a lawsuit pending in the Michigan Supreme Court. Our argument being that you can't do that, basically, that you've either got to let the people vote or you've got to adopt it. You can't adopt it and then take it apart.
Here to talk about that are our Friday political commentators. Ken Sikkema is Senior Policy Fellow at Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican Majority Leader in the Michigan State Senate. Brandon Dillon is a former Democratic legislator and a former Michigan Democratic Party Chair. Welcome back, Brandon.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Ken, give us some background. Why did the legislature enact these ballot initiatives only to later drastically change them?
Well, I think that sort of the fundamental reason is that when an initiative goes to the ballot, and let's say it gets adopted by the voters, the only way to really change it is, and it's almost impossible to amend it later because the Michigan Constitution requires a three-quarters vote to do that. And I think the thinking of the Republican legislature was, look, we don't like the extent of these proposals on sick leave and minimum wage. And if it does go to the ballot, they might get adopted. So let's adopt it and then amend it. And as Mark Brewer pointed out, it's the first time it's ever been done. And whether or not it's constitutional in terms of what they did or not is what's being sort of litigated and debated and argued over in the courts right now. But I think that's probably the background to what really motivated them is, you know, trying to make it more palatable from their point of view, that is, a Republican point of view.
Brandon, let's talk about what is constitutional. I mean, it's outlined in the Constitution what the legislature can do with their ballot initiative, that is, reject it or enact it or reject it and offer an alternative, and they both go up on the ballot. Does it say anything about enacting it and then changing it?
Well, I don't think so. And as Ken said, that's what's being litigated right now, or at least discussed at the Supreme Court. And, you know, I think it's pretty clear, given the questions that have been asked by the Supreme Court justices, that they're skeptical that this strategy is going to meet constitutional muster to basically just pass something that you don't like so that you can change it in a way that doesn't even resemble the original ballot initiative.
Yeah, Mark Brewer told me the Michigan Supreme Court justices were attentive. They asked questions, some more than others. He felt the lawyers on both sides felt that they were heard. They had their day in court. So, Ken, if you were a justice, what would be the things you'd be considering in making an advisory opinion on this issue?
Oh, boy, Lester, if I were a justice, I'm not a lawyer, so... And whether it's constitutional or not, I guess, you know, I'm kind of from the, you know, almost strict constructionist point of view. If the Michigan Constitution is silent about this maneuver, then I would probably think it's probably allowed. But it seems to me that, let's just hypothetically say it is allowed after all the legal maneuvering. I think the political stars have to line up precisely in order for this thing to work. I mean, it worked last fall because you had complete Republican control, including a Republican governor. And that's what I mean about the political stars have to line up precisely for this to work, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat. So I just don't think, even if it's allowed, it's going to change the calculation on the timing of some petition drives. But, you know, it's not going to occur that often.
Brandon, same question. If you're a justice, what are the important things to consider?
Well, like Ken, I'm certainly not an attorney, so I'm going to take a crack at this from a totally layman's or kind of political hack point of view. Look, I think that the main concern is, does this really strike a stake in the heart of the initiative process? If voters and those who decide to go to the ballot because they don't believe a legislature is responding to the issues they care about, can just have all their hard work essentially overturned by an end run in the legislature, I think I'd want to find out what are the limits to that if I'm a justice. And if there are no limits, then I think if ultimately they say that this is fine, then I think it's going to cause folks to think twice the next time they decide to do an initiative, particularly if it's something that is not in line with where the majority in the legislature has been over the last few cycles.
We should say the Supreme Court will be ruling on this yet this summer, and this is an advisory opinion. It's not binding. Do you think that makes much of a difference? Quickly, both of you. Ken?
Well, I think it's not going to be the final say here. This is going to go through the courts, and there's going to have to be a conclusive decision by the Michigan Supreme Court, not just an advisory opinion.
Brandon, you get the last word.
Yeah, I would say ultimately it would have to be a decision by the Supreme Court, not just an advisory opinion. But for those seeking to challenge the advisory opinion, they're going to know that this is probably ultimately going to be the decision of the Supreme Court. So I agree, but it will have an effect if they say that it was not constitutional.
Brandon Dillon is former Democratic legislator and former Michigan Democratic Party chair. Ken Sikkema is senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican majority leader in the Michigan State Senate. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lester.
Cheers.
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 Hi, Tammy.
Hi,
Hi, Lester.
That's Tammy Coxon with Tammy's Tastings, and we're here for another episode of Cheers to Michigan. Peaches in a mason jar. It reminds me of growing up on the farm. What are we doing with peaches?
We're starting to see some fresh peaches come into the market now, but not nearly as many as we would normally expect this time of year because that polar vortex that we got in January really damaged the southwestern Michigan peach trees. So I thought we should highlight a cocktail today that people could make with the peaches they put up last year so they can save those nice fresh peaches for eating out of hand this year.
I can see a lot of things you can do with peaches. What do you have in mind?
This drink is called the Edgewater Beach, and it's actually a classic cocktail that comes from Chicago, of all places. And it was named after the Edgewater Beach Hotel, which was built in 1916, although they probably borrowed this drink from an earlier cocktail called the Cohasset Punch, which dates back to at least 1899. So this drink has long roots, and you can sort of see that reflected in the ingredients and in the use of something like canned peaches. It does have a Detroit connection, though, because the recipe appears in the same 1951 cocktail book called Bottoms Up, where we rediscovered the Last Word cocktail from, which is, of course, Detroit's most famous cocktail. This particular version of the Edgewater Beach comes to us from a Chicago bartender, and he's revised it a little bit to reflect modern sensibilities, but thought it was really important to keep those canned peaches.
All right, you've also got two rums out. I saw you pour those in the tin. Why two rums?
Why not? Rum is actually a really varied spirit. People don't realize it. They'll tell me, oh, I don't like rum. You've told me I don't like rum, but I have 15 rums on my shelf. I bet I can find one that you like. And so when you can combine those rums of different styles, you can create a drink that doesn't taste like anything you could get out of a single bottle.
I remember one of these rums that we did in an episode in the past, but tell me about them.
So we're using two rums, as you noted today. We're using Dr. Bird. So this is a rum from Jamaica, but it's been selected by Two James Distillery in Detroit, and they go down and select them, blend them, bottle them, and sell that here in Michigan. And then to go along with that, we've got rum from Mammoth Distilling Company, which is up in northern Michigan area.
Right, near Traverse City, right?
Right. They've got a few different locations.
And you do what with them?
I started off by putting the peaches into a shaker tin along with about a tablespoon or a little bit less of a raw sugar, like a sugar in the raw or turbinado sugar, and then 3/4 of an ounce of lime juice and the shell from squeezing that lime juice, so about half of a lime's worth of shell. And that's going to bring some nice oils there. And that all gets muddled together until the sugar dissolves and the peaches break down. Then I'm going to add 3/4 of an ounce of each of the rums, 1/2 ounce of sweet vermouth, bunch of ice, shake it up really well, and then double strain it. So we don't want all those peach bits floating around in our cocktail, so I'm straining it with my Hawthorne strainer on top of the tin and then through a fine mesh strainer like a tea strainer into the glass.
Well, it's pretty, and I want to drink it, or at least take a sip, so I'm going to do that now if that's okay.
I'm a little worried because I know you don't like rum, but I hope you'll like this one.
We'll see. Love the peaches. I actually like how the peaches work with the rum. I especially noticed the Dr. Bird rum because I've had that in the past, and the peaches work really, really well with that.
Right. The Dr. Bird rum has a lot of these fruity esters that we find in Jamaican rums. So I think you're right that pairing that up with a fruit really plays off the strengths of the rum.
Well, for a rum drink, I'm going to say I really like this. I give it high marks for your Edgewater Beach.
Thanks, Lester. Cheers.
You can join Tammy Coxon and me at the Ann Arbor Art Fair from 2 to 5 tomorrow. Tammy will be serving free samples of some non-alcoholic mocktails, and we'll also have some information about the Cheers book, which will soon be released. We'll be at the Michigan Radio booth, stand, tent, whatever you want to call it. It's near Hill Auditorium. All next week, join us for the National Writers Series. Listen to conversations with award-winning authors like Gillian Flynn, Margaret Atwood, and more. 5 days, 5 premier storytellers. Join us Monday through Friday, 3 and 10 p.m. for the National Writers Series here on Michigan Radio. Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstrom. Contributors are Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Joel Danilevitz, Laura Weber-Davis, Anna Schlut, and Tim Sperlin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.